Hi, I'm Maya Grant.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
We have a very special episode for you listeners this week. In response to a request from a listener and in honor of the recent Jewish high holidays, we're going to be looking at some media that depicts Judaism and Jewishness and Jewish identity.
Well, specifically, as you wrote here, the very specialized subgenre of the shtetl musical. Yes. But also the idea of ethnic nostalgia, Jewish ethnic nostalgia. I think that's what we're looking at today.
Yeah, through Fiddler on the Roof, Yentl, and the recently Emmy-feted Mrs. Maisel.
So first, how are we doing? What are we drinking?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. I'm drinking my mezcal that I smuggled back from Mexico. How about you? How are you doing? What are you drinking?
I'm doing all right. I have to say for this episode, I'm drinking tea. I'm sorry. It's just that the past two nights I was drinking and I don't really ever drink unless it's this podcast and I'm hungover. I'm sorry. I'm old. I can't drink anymore. I have three cocktails and I'm like,
Maya, ugh. Our brand, come on. Our brand.
I could pretend, but I'm not going to, guys. I have to be honest with you. I'm hungover.
I'm sure the listeners appreciate your candor, but you should also remember that there is really only one cure for a hangover, right?
And that's more drinking?
That's more drinking.
Somebody I ran into, we were talking about drinking and aging, and he was like, yeah, the B-side is just no good anymore. And I just feel like that is very true. So there was something you were going to tell me about.
Yeah, I wanted to share one thought I had in relation to our recent episode we just did about white feminism. And we talked about white women's tears. We talked about it in the context of white women who claim to be feminists, claim to be social justice activists, but when they get called out for their, you know, blind spots, they play victim, basically.
Yes.
That was the sort of tier.
How can I be racist? I'm so good.
Right. Yeah. So I was thinking about that, and I had this really horrible cynical thought, which, forgive me, listeners, I know this is terribly cynical, but I was thinking, in the news recently has been that it's looking increasingly likely that Christine Blasey Ford is going to be testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee in regard to Brett Kavanaugh and how he sexually assaulted her as a teen. And I hope she cries. Because what is more powerful in American culture than a crying blonde woman? And those white women tears, one of the things we didn't mention in that previous episode is that white women's tears have been used as justification for violence against African Americans a lot in the history of this nation.
Yep.
So I'm actually getting kind of excited about the idea of turning that around and using them as a weapon against a rich white guy.
Oh, God, we can only hope. Jesus Christ. Let's put some white women tears to actual good use. We got a request this week from one of our listeners, Arnim Summer, who asked, would you ruin Yentl for me? And like, wow, to be asked that. I feel like in some ways, this is what I was maybe put on earth to do, what maybe we were put together to do. When you asked me to join you on this podcast, it was for this moment.
It all makes sense now.
But also there's a side of it that feels like asking Jewesses to ruin Yentl. I almost feel like you know how now they're making custom porn? Where because there's so much porn, people can't make money on porn anymore. The way that porn stars are making money is by doing custom porn movies for people. And actually, John Ronson has a beautiful little mini series podcast on it called The Butterfly Effect, where he talks to a lot of these custom porn makers. And I feel like there's something a little custom porny about asking us to ruin Yentl. I mean, I'm into it. Look, I'm into it. Hey, but, you know.
I'm happy to do it. Yeah. Give the people what they want. So when we were talking about how we could build an episode around Yentl, it being not the most contemporary current movie.
Yeah.
We thought of a bunch of different angles, but one of the things that came up, because we were talking about different movies about Jews, and it came up that I've never seen Yentl, and Maya had never seen Fiddler on the Roof, which blew my mind.
I know, guys. But here's the other thing that we're thinking about is that at the Emmys, in the comedy award section, the show The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is an Amazon show about sort of a Jewish female stand-up comedian in the late 50s, early 60s, that show cleaned up. Best director, best show, best first written episode, best actress, best supporting actress. That show cleaned up. And what's interesting about that show is that it's almost this nostalgic reintroduction of Jewishness as an ethnicity, mm-hmm. of a kind of like ethnic Jewishness in contemporary culture. So we thought that we would, in honor of that, or rather in consideration of that, that it actually isn't bad to go back and look at Yentl and look at Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay, so let's start with Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay.
For those who may be unfamiliar, Fiddler on the Roof was a huge hit Broadway musical that premiered in 1964. And it's about a man, a dairy guy, he's a dairy farmer who lives in Eastern Europe in a little Jewish village
called Anatevia.
Now, Anatevka.
But also, it was based on the short stories of Sholem Aleichem.
Yes, that's right. And Tevye has these multiple daughters. I think there's five of them.
Five of them, yeah.
And he's got to get them married off. And it's this sort of turn of the 20th century. And changes are happening in, I think they're supposed to be in Russia.
Yes.
And he's navigating these changes. He's negotiating the emergence of a sort of modern era.
And so Sholem Aleichem was this Yiddish writer. Like, let's really set this up because it also sets up Yentl. Mm. There was at the end of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century, there was kind of an emergence of a non-religious Jewish culture. Mm. And you had a split between Zionists and people who were real, like Yiddishists, who weren't Zionists, who were Bundists. I mean, they were all socialists, but some people were like, let's go to Israel. And some people were like, no, we're going to do this Yiddish thing right here. And you had all of these writers who came from a religious background, but they were there to observe Jewish life writing in Yiddish and observe and write about with sort of a great deal of affection, but also bitterness and sarcasm and like a real sharp point of view.
I mean, they're Jewish.
I mean, but I think a lot of what we know of as that kind of Jewish perspective emerged in that time when modernism encountered shtetl life and emerged through these short story writers, one of whom wrote the story that Yentl is based on.
Yeah, which
so
we'll get to
a
in
lot
a
of this, which we're going to get to in a moment. So Sholem Aleichem wrote all of these stories about this village life, and then they sort of made it into one coherent tale. Mm-hmm. For Fiddler on the Roof.
Right. And that was made into a film in 1971. And it was a huge hit film, nominated for and won a bunch of Oscars, and is like one of the classics of cinema musicals.
And I'd never seen it.
And they did you not go to Hebrew school? They make you watch it in Hebrew school.
Because I went to school with Zionist Israeli teachers who just showed us Holocaust stuff instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little different.
Okay. Here's what I want to do first, Maya.
Okay.
You had never seen it before. You watched Fiddler on the Roof for the first time as an adult. I want to hear your thoughts and impressions.
I thought that it's attempting to be a musical that is also a historical document of a moment in which time was changing. Mm-hmm, each of the daughters, in terms of the story, each of the daughters who is old enough to be married gets married in such a way that undoes tradition. And so the changing of tradition is sort of symbolized by these three daughters. One of them wants to marry her sort of poor childhood friend and not be match made with the sort of best, most financially like good match ever. She marries for love. And then another one marries a sort of young communist idealist.
Yes.
And then another one falls into a local like Cossack non-Jew. And each of them is sort of through sex and love showing that times are changing. And there's a good little mini pogrom that happens at the end of the wedding. I felt like it was trying to set up this kind of poor life. And I think that when there is nostalgic film or TV, and this wasn't the only thing, I was just thinking about this, like Fiddler on the Roof was coming out at the same time as Little House on the Prairie. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. Yeah.
So there's this way in which it's like, we were poor, we didn't have anything, life was hard, but life was simpler then. And it's
right.
And
it was purer. You know? It was more authentic.
Yeah, it was more authentic, and it's attempting in some ways to be a little dirty and authentic in how it's presenting these things. And like, you feel the yearning. The opening song is about tradition.
Yes.
Like, how do we live our terrible life when life is so hard? Tradition. And then the rest of the musical undoes tradition. Like, tradition is dismantled over the rest of the musical. So Tevye, the milkman, it's kind of he's simple, but has this kind of mother wit. And you see him as this sort of perfect figure struggling with this transformation.
Right.
And I feel like I get that. And this is also happening at the end of the 60s, where it's like, a lot of people are going to be like back to the landers. Mm. Like, there's something in the culture, which I think is in the chaos of the 60s and 70s, yearning for this simpler time.
I think that's absolutely correct. So the thing that really fascinates me about Fiddler is the way that it places like the location of that change, the change from the traditional way of life to a more modern, more assimilated kind of Jewish identity.
Yeah.
The location of that is in the girls, in the women, and how their marriage arrangements are made.
Mm-hmm.
I find that really interesting because the movie's not about the girls. It's about Tevye and what he's going through, and it's from his perspective.
And his pain over it and his
yes.
struggle over it. And what should I do about this? And yeah, I mean, spoiler alert, one of the daughters marries this like Christian and is dead to him. And, you know, and it's like, and we feel his pain.
I think that's really interesting, though, that for Tevye, there's actually turns out to be a pretty clear, bright line for how far he can bend is how he literally puts it, right? He says, if I bend this far, I will break. And the bright line is intermarriage with a Gentile.
Yeah.
I mean, it's of a piece with Jewish tradition, which is matrilineal in passing on Jewishness.
Right.
I don't know if people know, but Jews consider you to be Jewish if your mother is Jewish.
Right.
It's maybe a little more complicated than that, but that's the gist of it. So a lot of importance is put on a woman marrying another Jew and keeping the Jewishness in the Jewish tribe.
And Jews are also not into, like, unlike Christians and evangelical Christians, we don't proselytize. We don't, like, like, oh, let's make some more Jews. Like, no, we're not so into that.
Well, this could be an appropriate moment to maybe do a quick explainer for any listeners who aren't that familiar with mm-hmm. how the whole thing works. Because recently, like in 2016, right, during mm-hmm. the election, I tweeted that Bernie was the first Jewish person to win a presidential primary. And I got mm-hmm. a lot of people pushing back and being like, Bernie's not Jewish, he's agnostic. And I realized that there's some confusion out there around Jewish identity. So a quick explainer. Jews consider themselves a nationality or ethnicity as much as a religion. And historically speaking, basically for the better part of the last 2,000 years, Jews were a nation or a nationality without an actual homeland, without a country. So the religion and the traditions were a really, really important component of maintaining a sense of identity as Jews in the absence of a homeland, in the absence of a literal, physical, geographical place that you could say is the country of Judea.
And I would like to also add that part of the reason that that is so is because people fucking hated the Jews so much. I actually think that if people had been more like, sure, we can assimilate you and bring you in, Jews would have been like, fuck that nation, homeland thing. But I feel like anti-Semitism in a lot of ways defines Jewishness. And one of the things we're going to have to talk about is the way that now in the States, at a certain point, Jewishness became whiteness in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Whiteness like absorbed Jewishness. Jewishness is a separate ethnicity other than some, you know, good little neo-Nazis over there.
Right.
Is sort of melting away or disappearing in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the, you know, it's like the Lenny Bruce line where this is in 1963 when it's 1961 when he did Live at Carnegie Hall, where he's like, I'm of the Semitic background, so I've experienced maybe 30% of the Negro Jews. Like, he's like talking about
so
like,
good.
he's very aware of it. And he said it was worse when I was coming up, and it was, you know, it was like segregated everything, and we had to go to CCNY, Circumcised Citizens of New York, and blah 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 blah. But now it's like being cool. Being Jewish is cool. It's hip to be Jewish. And he completely.
That's amazing.
He's acknowledging in the moment of the early 60s, the fact that whatever anti-Semitism he grew up with has like sort of flipped over, and it has not yet for Black people, and it is not for Puerto Rican people. And in his vision of the world, it will. Just give them time. And then he's like, and then what are you going to do? If the Venusians aren't scufflers, we're screwed. It's like whoever's the next ethnicity is going to like come in.
That's genius.
And take up that mental.
That's
but he's,
amazing.
He's noting the change. But what's also interesting, just back to Fiddler, is that even though it's from Tevye's point of view, he's the older person seeing the shift in the younger generation.
Yeah.
And he's there to sort of suffer that and accept that, which in some ways you're like, oh, like, yeah, we're going to put it from the perspective of the person who has to witness the change and feel that.
Right.
But it's also happening at a time when the Cossacks, when the Russians kick all the Jews out of the town.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have to disperse to the winds, and some go to Palestine and some go to the United States, but they all have to escape. So it is also this way of like, you're going to be forced into modernity one way or another.
Right, whether you
and
like
we're
it
watching
or not.
It, whether you like it or not. So it's coming from both directions.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I always read that ending as, you know, the whole town of Anatevka is basically like liquidated. Everyone has to leave. And to me, this was very much like Hollywood executives and creatives of the 60s. There are a lot of Jewish people, and they're thinking hard about what their parents and grandparents did and went through. And so while there's a nostalgia for a simpler time, there's also a need to make that connection. Not just this was a better, simpler time, but also these were the people who came here and were my people. I don't know. Like, that's a really important part of the narrative to me, is that ultimately it ends with, we're going to America.
Yes. Yes. And that it's almost maybe for those 60s Jews who are starting to lose their ethnic identity.
Yeah.
A way of being like, this is where you're from. Like, do not forget that. This is where you're from. And I was actually like, I thought it was really, you know, Topol, who is this Israeli performer who played Tevye, Zero Mostel, who's this very famous broad comedian, played Tevye on Broadway. He was not cast in the movie, which was a little bit of a thing at the time, because the director, Norman Jewison, said that everybody would only see him as Zero Mostel and they would never see him as Tevye.
Mm.
Like that his personality would like black hole.
He was
like,
bigger than the character.
He was too big for the character. He's amazing. It's amazing to see such sort of Jewishness, such kind of dirty Jewishness
yeah.
on screen.
I mean, it's right there with the Jewishness.
They're also like plucking chickens and like their skin isn't so great. Do you know what I mean? Like mama doesn't look good. Like it's like it's kind of, you know, nice and dirty in that way. It's,
I think that's in itself kind of interesting because American Jews are not a very outdoors people. We're not a very rural people. And I think that being able to think about our past as having involved like farming kind of work, it is interesting.
Well, but I always think about that, like, why do we eat rye bread? Because rye was poor food. Why did, you know, like...
Sure. No, why are you preserving herring in a jar?
Yeah.
In a jar,
yeah.
Because you have to.
Because
you have to. But I don't have to. I don't have to eat that.
I actually am very anti-gefilte fish. I've even made it myself once from scratch.
Oh my God.
I will not even have it. I made my, in the hopes that like maybe if I make it, I will understand why. And then I was like, no, it is disgusting and I will never have it in my house.
I actually like gefilte fish, but it's one of those like English people like Marmite kind of things. Like you're raised on it. You don't know any better when you're young. And then by the time you're grown, you're like used to it.
It's too late. It's too late. So Fiddler was great. My son ended up sitting and watching it with me, which was really amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was very like, I knew all the songs. I just somehow had never seen the movie. But it is interesting to see a musical try and in some ways make it look real. I don't know how else to say it. Like try, like have this version of it that wasn't glossy.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is really important in terms of talking about why we're here, which is Yentl.
Yes, it's time to move on to Yentl.
Yentl is glossy. Okay, Yentl is also based on a short story by Yiddishist writer Isaac Bashevis Singer, who's a Nobel Prize winning author who wrote about Jewish life. Mm-hmm. He wrote this beautiful story. I think it's called Yentl, the Yeshiva Boy.
It is.
And I read it actually yesterday. Oh my God, it's beautiful. Oh. It's so beautiful. But it's this story about a young girl who's raised by her father and who is just awkward and not female and just everything about her, her kind of angular body, and she's kind of weird and she can't do household things and she would study with her father. And when he dies, she decides to pretend to be a boy and joins a yeshiva. And I have to say these lines because they're the best fucking lines and Barbara Streisand doesn't use them. And I feel like this sets up the failures of the movie.
Okay.
Her father told Yentl to lock the doors and drape the windows, and then together they pored over the Pentateuch, the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the commentaries. She had proved so apt a pupil that her father used to say, "Yentl, you have the soul of a man. So why was I born a woman? Even heaven makes mistakes."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's so Jewish.
Yeah.
That's so Jewish.
Yeah. I mean, and it also kind of hints at like a transgender sort of identity for this character.
Yes.
But it's definitely not the case in the movie.
And actually in the story, so what happens with Yentl is that she ends up marrying a woman and in the story, like taking advantage of her ignorance because this young proper girl doesn't really know about sex. So she's not really going to understand. Mm-hmm. And it says that there was blood on the wedding sheets after their first night together, mm-hmm. which means that some kind of sex happened, some kind of penetration happened. So there was some sexual relation. So there is sexuality in the story that points to kind of transness and queerness and being in between and eroticism that mm-hmm. is not in the movie.
The movie had its genesis all the way back in 1969 when Barbara Streisand bought the rights to that short story and wanted to make it into a film starring her. And she like went through this whole process over well over a decade trying to get this movie made with executives telling her she was old, too old to play the character, and producers signing on, and then studios picking it up and then dropping it. And then she finally got the project greenlit in 1982 and started shooting for a 1983 release. Streisand co-wrote it in the sense that I think she had a script written by somebody and she basically rewrote it. She directed it and she stars in it. And it was pretty well received critically.
Yeah, she won a Golden Globe for Best Director that year.
Yeah, first woman, I believe, to win a Golden Globe for Best Director. And it got nominated for a bunch of Oscars, though not Best Director.
Right.
And I watched it for the first time yesterday.
Yes.
So I want to share my thoughts.
Yes, please. Yes, because I grew up watching that movie. So would like to, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I had never seen it. I remember it came out when I was a kid and I just kind of vaguely perceived that it looked kind of boring. And yes. Let me say off the top that I was right. It's boring. But I jotted notes while I was watching it. And so I'm going to read you verbatim a few of my notes, not all of them. Number one that I'm going to read that wasn't the first thing I wrote is credit for being a musical where only one person sings.
Yep. That person is Barbara Streisand.
Only Barbara Streisand. All the musical numbers, to the extent that they're even musical numbers, it's really just like a musical inner monologue, voiceover kind of thing. But
yes.
She sings all the songs. I wrote, the first 15 minutes are the exact same plot as Disney's Beauty and the Beast. Now, to be fair, this movie came out in 1983 and Beauty and the Beast wasn't until, like, I don't know, 1991 or something. So
they
clearly copied her. But like it starts with she's in the shtetl and it's like the village in Beauty and the Beast. And all she wants to do is read books. And everyone's like, what a strange girl that Yentl is. She just doesn't quite fit in with the rest of us. And we're all doing our fishmongering and our eggmongering and whatever, and she just doesn't get it. And then like she goes home and she's got her papa who's a scholar and he gets her and he teaches her Talmud, which is the study of Jewish law, which is what she wants to really do, is study Talmud, but only men are allowed to. So I was like, wow, this is Beauty and the Beast. But then after her father passes away, Yentl disguises herself as a boy and goes to enroll in a yeshiva, which is a school where young men could study Talmud. And after that, the movie becomes Twelfth Night, Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. It's like the exact same plot. Girl disguises herself as a boy. She falls in love with the man. The man's in love with another woman. The woman falls in love with her, thinking she's a boy. It's like, I've seen this plot before for sure.
Yes.
Okay. Next, I wrote, all she wants in life is to argue with people and fuck Mandy Patinkin. How am I not going to relate to that?
It's true. He was hot.
I mean, I love me some Mandy Patinkin. I mean, I kind of like some older Mandy Patinkin too. He's a sexy ass man. And he's the one she falls in love with, the other yeshiva student. And like she does depict the study of Talmud as being arguing, which I guess is what it actually is or was. I don't know.
Right.
You mostly discuss and like share your interpretation of historical scholars' interpretation of the Bible, and you argue over it. I mean, it's so Jewish. Next, I wrote, is Yentl the only woman who ever wanted something different? Because there's no other woman in the movie who seems at all uncomfortable with the gender roles. They're all fine with it.
Yeah.
Next I wrote, the songs are so fucking pointless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are. I mean, the whole thing about a musical is that the music is supposed to break out when there is no other way of expressing the emotions.
Right.
When there is no, like, my feelings are so big that, and as for Barbara Streisand, that could be true as an actor. She feels like this is where I must break out into song. But yeah, there's something about it that doesn't quite,
The musical numbers don't move the story forward.
Right.
Then I wrote, studying Talmud seems really uninteresting. For fuck's sake, go enroll at a university. And finally, my last note was, okay, I know it's Mandy Patinkin, but what does she see in this guy?
Yeah.
Because by the end of the movie, he's just kind of a piece of shit. So those are my initial reactions. What I'd like to get into is,
yes,
I really think it's interesting the way that Fiddler used women and marriage as this place to talk about changing traditions and,
yes,
assimilation.
About the world changing.
And the, yeah, world changing, yeah. This movie, it almost seems like, I don't want to say in a dialogue, but it's like, it is in some ways jumping off from there and talking about gender and shtetl life, gender and the roles of women and women's, you know, obligations, but from a very different point of view.
Well, because it's supposed to be from the woman's point of view, or specifically from Barbara Streisand's point of view. Yes. I mean, I feel like that's yeah, what it comes down to.
Exactly.
Like, Fiddler on the Roof is so clearly a fable of this bigger story, and Yentl doesn't feel like that.
Right.
Like, it doesn't feel, it feels like a story about Barbara Streisand. It was weirdly also not very Jewish in terms of a kind of sense of humor. And it was weird in terms of it being in dialogue with Fiddler. So we have another shtetl musical, right?
Right.
That's about marriage and tradition and change. But it's filmed, it's so goyishly filmed. Mm. It felt like everything has like Vaseline on the lens. It's beautifully shot, like the camera, like the edits, it's very like well done.
Uh-huh.
But there's a way in which the world that it's painting is so romantic.
Yes.
That it's there isn't a place for any kind of roughness or sense of humor. Or like, it's so, and the place that it has the least sense of humor is that Barbara Streisand is, it's impossible for her to have a sense of humor about herself.
Yeah.
Like, it's so unwilling to let her do a pratfall, to let her do, it's almost like, I wish like Carol Burnett had done it instead. Like, I don't know how else to describe
yeah,
it. Like,
yeah,
this way in which there's no place for her to make a fool out of herself. And when she does, it's with so much sympathy for her.
Yeah. It's also very, it's kind of like reverent in its treatment of the traditions of Judaism. And she's so goddamn sincere. And it's like hard to hold that against her, because how can you criticize someone for their sincerity? How can you criticize someone, right, for trying hard to really, she really wants to make a fine film. She also clearly wants to make like an Oscar film. Like, yes, it's everything 1982 thinks is Oscar worthy in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But yeah, there's none of that self-reflection and like slight cynicism that is really like authentically Jewish. It feels inauthentically Jewish in that way, because it, yeah, is not, it's not the Jewish way to be so reverent. It's not the Jewish way to romanticize about ourselves. Like,
yes,
maybe about some things, but not about ourselves.
Like, you can have nostalgia for it, but that doesn't mean you romanticize it.
Right, right. That's one really stark difference between the two films. I love the way you wrote in our planning document, it makes Fiddler look like a documentary.
Yes, because Fiddler ends up feeling so much more genuine, weirdly.
Yeah,
because,
yeah,
because it's like women plucking chickens, and like the house they live in is shitty. And like, that's the thing about, all of a sudden she's, her father is a scholar and they live in this big, beautiful multi-room house. And you're like, no,
yeah,
they didn't.
Yeah.
No, they did not. Everything has to be, have this gloss on it that Jewish life didn't have.
Yeah, I agree. And I really want to go back to what you said about it feeling less like a universal story or even a Jewish fable, and more like it's just a individual story about Barbara Streisand, because I absolutely noted that when I was watching it. In particular, what I noticed is the way that the film depicts Yentl, the character, as being this misfit, this unique, out-of-place misfit who has no place in society.
Right.
What makes her a misfit is that she's a woman who has a passion for studying Talmud.
Yes.
But she can't because she's a woman. And so the opportunity for a more generalizable story about gender roles, about traditional right. gender roles and how they could be suffocating to women, like that's there. It's just right there in the material. And she kind of comes close in many places. There's literally a scene where they're in temple and the men are on the first floor praying and the women all have to be on the second floor in like a gallery. And Yentl is watching through bars, literally through bars right. while the men pray. And it's like not subtle at all. She's totally trapped by this gender role that's suffocating to her. Great. But then every other woman in the movie is totally fine with their gender roles.
Yes.
They are yes. all fine with it. She is the only one that has any issue. All the men are fine with it. The only one who's not is Papa, and well, he's dead. So in constructing it that way, there's only one way you can read it, which is like Yentl's this exception. She's not a woman like any woman who just wants to be a fully realized person. She's some kind of special person.
Yes.
Everyone else is fine with what they're given, but she needs more. So it does become about her as an individual and less about a larger social structure kind of theme.
And I feel like the story, the short story, which you can see online, if you look up Yentl the Yeshiva Boy, Commentary Magazine has it archived. And nice. It's really beautiful. And in it, it's like, Yentl ends up being a stand-in for this tension between the performance of gender and what you really are. And by dressing as this man, she becomes this man. Her desire, she looks at Hadas and is like, God, she's really attractive. Like there is a tension mm-hmm. in terms of really feeling this different sexuality oh. and really feeling this kind of like glee. She says, Anshel was seized by both fear and glee as a person who's planning to deceive the whole community. She remembered the saying, the public are fools. She stood up and said aloud, now I'll really start something. Like there's this way in which she oh, wants wow. to push how far her gender can go. And she's kind of in a fever about it. And the scene in which she reveals to Avigdor, to the man that she desires and is in love with, that she's a woman is very like tense and very kind of hard. And there's this sense where you don't know what happens to the Yentl Anshel character. Mm-hmm. Like you don't know what's going to happen to her. And it's almost like she disappears for the rest of her life into pretending to be this man in various small yeshivas. And what's interesting is at the end of Yentl, the movie, she's on a boat going to America where she can be herself,
whoever she wants to be. Yeah,
right.
That tickled me. I like the ending where she's like striding around a refugee boat. She's like strutting around a refugee boat with a little knit cap and a scarf, singing this song about how the future is so bright and she can do whatever she wants to do. And it rings fairly hollow, in my opinion. Yeah, especially because I'm like, I'm not sure that the Jewish community in America is going to be so much more flexible about gender roles that they're just going to welcome you into the yeshiva. So I don't really know what she's going to do in America that's going to be so different.
Right.
So what you just said about in the story, Yentl / Anshel is almost feeling attracted to Hadas, who's played by Amy Irving in the movie. In the movie, they play it like a little differently where she's envious of Hadas because Hadas yes. is the perfect embodiment of the traditional woman. She just everything
of what people want from women exactly. and what women would want themselves. And she feels like, why can't I be that?
Right. And who wouldn't want that? I mean, she does the song, the yes. voiceover song does yes. say like, who wouldn't want that? So there's a little bit of an element of sexuality ambiguity there, but it's not forefronted.
Not really.
What's more forefronted is this idea of like, Yentl being trapped because the only way she can be the person she wants to be is to disguise herself as a man. But then everything changes once she falls in love with Mandy Patinkin. And it's
Which again is understandable.
It's I mean, honestly, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
But there's a whole song again where she sings about these new feelings she's having for Mandy Patinkin, and she literally stands in front of the mirror and unbinds her chest during the song. She takes off her chest binding that she's, you know, using to disguise herself as a man. And it's like not subtle. It's now that she's experiencing romantic love and sexual attraction to a man, she no longer wants to be a man. Now her femininity, her womanness is coming out. And now she's trapped because if she wants to be with him romantically and sexually, she has to be like Amy Irving's character, but she can't. But if she wants to be a scholar, she has to suppress any of those womanly desires.
Right.
When it comes to the idea of sexual desire, it really only exists to further trap Yentl in between roles and emphasize her misfitness, that she can't occupy any given role.
But also that there's that in the story too, but she feels the empowerment and the limits of being both a man and a woman. She feels sexual in both directions, and she feels power in both directions, and she feels limited in both directions. And it's kind of hard and unresolvable. And there's something almost a little like supernatural about it, or that's how they find it. Like it's because it's also such a superstitious culture.
Yes.
And I feel like that's also the thing that I felt like Yentl doesn't have, that almost made, like, as I was saying, almost made Fiddler feel like a documentary, is that the world of Jewishness then, and they're really amazing books. There's a really amazing book called Oh, the Pity of It All by Amos Elon. It was very, in a lot of ways, very small town and very limited and very provincial and very superstitious. I've been reading the stories of another one. So, you know, Yentl is based on Isaac Bashevis Singer, and Fiddler was based on the stories of Sholem Aleichem. There was also a famous Yiddish writer named Chaim Grad, and I was reading his stories, and all of these men who were writing then in Yiddish were writing from the perspective of people getting this more sophisticated, global understanding of a bigger world, and writing with both love and yearning and judgment of this limited, provincial, superstitious background.
Yeah.
And they are, and there isn't like one perspective on it. It's a complex perspective on it.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was more accurately captured by Fiddler than it was by Yentl. Like there wasn't that kind of ambivalence of what it is.
Yeah. And I think that might come from Streisand feeling a responsibility to create a positive depiction.
Yeah.
She wants to sell Judaism. I mean, she was told for like over a decade, you can't make this movie. It's too Jewish. It won't sell to a mainstream audience. So maybe she felt a lot of pressure to depict Judaism in a very positive light and show it as this intellectual pursuit.
In a very goyish light, in a very like, in a very beautiful, like pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Mm.
So one thing that you noted right before we started recording that I thought was so smart was that Fiddler and Yentl really were coming out of the same Jewish moment, the same generation of makers who were performing a nostalgia of the Jewishness of their grandparents.
Yeah.
They were performing a nostalgia for the Jewishness of a really specific amount of time ago. And now we have Mrs. Maisel that's performing a nostalgia for the Jewishness one generation after that.
Yes.
Or generation and a half after that, where Amy Sherman Palladino, who made Mrs. Maisel, who is best known for the Gilmore Girls, which is like the goyish version of it, very wisecracking, sharp tongue, but they're so white, like no funny noses. Her dad was a comedian in that era of Mrs. Maisel.
No kidding.
And so this is her, and he was Jewish, and this is her nostalgia, except her nostalgia places us in the New York world of the late 50s, early 60s, where you have Jews coming into, as Lenny Bruce said, you know, the 30% of the Negro Jews, like coming into a kind of financial power.
Yes. And kind of mainstream acceptance as white people. Yeah.
Yes.
I always like to joke that I've only been white since 1967. Thank you for laughing at that. A lot of people don't get what I'm saying, but that's what that joke is. Like, Jews were not necessarily considered white. The 60s were that era that really changed the position of Jews in American culture from being a very marginalized group to just really kind of being part of the mainstream.
And that came out of the what it came out of, there's a really amazing book, The Invention of Whiteness. Mm. It came out of World War II.
Yeah.
Like they were still trying to segregate black people from white people. And they're like, all right, we'll include the Jews in this. So post-World War II, you have this shift in how Jews are considered in American culture. And I feel like the show is trying to reinscribe a very ethnic Jewishness.
Yeah.
And it's a great show. Like, I loved that show because I'm the audience for it. But there's a scene between the two Jewish fathers, the main character's father and her father-in-law. And it is so Jewish. Everything about the timing and the jokes and the subtext and the way that they're, it's like, it's such an amazing scene.
It is a type of Jewishness. It's out there. It's like, these characters are Jewish. It's not subtle or coded or you have to pay attention to pick up on it by any means. But also it is very divorced from any kind of like religious tradition. There is a scene where they're in temple.
Right.
But that's one scene. And for the most part, it's about like inviting the rabbi. In fact, that's the first episode, right? Inviting the rabbi over for dinner and the prestige of having the rabbi over for dinner. It's not anything to do with religion per se, but yeah, that ethnic Jewishness. What I find interesting is the way that the Jewishness of Mrs. Maisel is not fraught in any way. There's no downside to it. They never encounter people who are uncomfortable with it, much less actively hostile to it. They don't even encounter people who are ignorant about it. It's just sort of taken for granted. People are Jewish.
The other thing, just because so much of what we're talking about with both Yentl and Fiddler is the role of like women and women's changing roles.
Yes.
It's an ethnic Jewishness without anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Also, it is a female comedian, a woman comic, sort of being this new thing without any real sexism. And then her character played by Alex Bornstein, who's fantastic, who plays this kind of like dyke manager. She sort of runs the bar in the village where she starts doing stand-up and takes her on as this protege and sees something in her and goes, you're going to be a star, kid. It's like she's a lesbian in the 50s and 60s with no homophobia for this Jewish woman who's going to be a comedian for the first time with no sexism and no anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And that's the fairy tale of it. That's kind of the pleasure of it. They get to be these identities without any like downside, without any violence, without any like, it's, when she gets heckled a little bit, there's no real stake in it. There's no real problem.
Which is interesting because like, the combination of misogyny and anti-Semitism I get just on Twitter today in 2018 would suggest that a Jewish woman getting on stage to do comedy in the 60s, you know, it might not be so pretty.
Right, right. Well, and also because I think one of the comedians that people talk about the most in relation to the show is Joan Rivers. Mm. Joan Rivers is such an interesting figure. Because in order to be the raw comedian that she was, she was also extremely sexist and extremely not open and extremely afraid of like the kind of, she would be so judgmental of women who were like fat or ugly or like whatever, mm-hmm. because she had to be this very specific kind of femininity to then be the raw sort of cyclone that she was on stage. And Midge, the main character, seems to have none of that drama. She seems to have no internal tension. Like there seems to be no conflict within her about anything.
Yeah, the show actually tries to draw out a little bit of conflict around her leaving her husband or him leaving her and whether they'll get back together. And as a viewer, you're like, nobody cares about that. Nobody wants her to get back together with the husband. We don't want her to be a comedian. Yeah, I love the show. I will say I have some mild criticisms of it. There's some things I would have done differently, but it's just so goddamn entertaining. I'm not going to be upset about it. But here's my question now. You have a show that is giving you this sort of candy-coated version of nostalgia.
Yes.
It's showing you Jews in the 60s with no anti-Semitism and a woman trying to make it in a field that is today hostile to women.
Oh.
With no real meaningful hostility directed her way.
Absolutely.
In its way, is that more feminist than if you just outright depicted her facing misogyny and having to deal with it? Is there something kind of feminist about like, no, we're just going to reimagine the past? It's almost like Inglourious Bastards.
It's exactly that I was going to bring up. That was literally what was going to come out of my mouth next.
Amazing.
Yes.
Right? Like, let's just re-envision the past the way we wish it had been.
Absolutely. Like, that's what I love about Inglourious Basterds. That's why I think it's Tarantino's best film, is that it's like reimagines this past where Americans actually were Nazi hunters, which they were not. They were absolutely not. They knew this shit was going on. It took them a while to actually give a shit. Like, they were not Nazi hunters. And it reimagines this time where we're going to like burn Hitler down in this theater. And it's like
cinema is going to kill Hitler.
Yeah, exactly. Cinema is going to kill Hitler. It's true. And I think that one thing that I read about Mrs. Maisel is that it almost creates an imaginary lineage for comedians like Ali Wong.
Oh,
like this is where she comes from. And if that character doesn't exist, we'll make one up.
Mm.
And I feel like that's something that you see a lot. That was something that like the Masons did, because there were all these men who were anxious about masculinity because they were having to go and work and be industrious. So they were like, men, be industrious, like Solomon was back in the day. Like it created a fictional mythic backstory to manage the anxieties of the present moment.
Huh. That's really interesting to think about it that way. And I wonder if that's effective. I wonder if that, like, to me, that makes sense that, by creating this mythic character, this figure of the female comedian who's bawdy and blue and pushing boundaries, and everyone's just like, you're great.
And
you're
it's totally best. Unconflicted about it.
Yeah,
and
she's not conflicted.
She doesn't seem to have any problem with it. Nobody embarrasses her. You don't see her just raw over it. Like, not at all.
Is that more powerful than either depicting the reality of the situation or not depicting it at all and giving women like Ali Wong credit for being the groundbreaking innovators they are?
I don't know. Like, I feel like it's entertaining. It's sort of like what we were saying about Queer Eye. Like, it's so wonderful as long as you don't think about it too hard.
That's fair.
It's so pleasurable that in terms of Jewishness, and I like the sort of reinscription of the ethnicness of Jewishness.
Yeah.
That there was an ethnic Jewishness, that they did work in the garment district.
Right, that being Jewish is about working in the garment district. Yeah.
But you know what it reminds me of? I had this crazy boss. This is a whole other story for another time. But she grew up as this Connecticut Jew. And there was a way in which the Connecticut Jews were trying so hard to be white,
mm-hmm.
there was a way in which they straightened their hair, they got nose jobs, mm-hmm. they built these very fancy country clubs that were like just as fancy as the white country clubs, even fancier. They were trying to assimilate in a really, really specific way. They were trying to disappear into whiteness.
Yeah.
And that performance that it's doing in Maisel, they're Jewish, but there's also this sort of like upper class Jewishness that it's painting that's interesting to see.
There's not any connection you would naturally make when watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel between the characters you're seeing and the characters of Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes.
Though generationally, there's clear direct connection.
Although they don't have grandma around.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true. It's true. All right. We're going to have to leave. We're going to have to chew on that. We're going to have to chew on that.
I guess there's no point in doing the drunkometer because I'm the only one who's been drinking.
I'm sorry. I do want to share one quick hot sauce, though, in case people missed it.
Okay.
So there's this congressman in Arizona named Paul Gosar, and he's Republican, and he's running for re-election. And there is a campaign ad against him where all these people talk about how he's like a shitty congressman and isn't going for Arizona's values. And then at the end of the ad, it turns out that all the people who've just been talking are his siblings.
Oh my God.
I think we might have to get into campaign ads. We are getting ready for so I just want to.
That's a rich topic.
Paul Gosar, look it up, guys. I would like to just put a pin in that for our next episode.
And hot sauce award to all the siblings.
Yes, absolutely. So if you have any thoughts about Jewishness and the portrayals of ethnic Jewishness, or if you have anything else that you need us to ruin for you, as Arnim Summer did, thank you so much for that idea. Email us at saucepodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter or Instagram at saucepodcast. You all need to rate us on iTunes. I know that you're listening. You're listening every week. Go rate us so other people can find us.
I can't emphasize this enough because just today I was looking for us on iTunes. And when you put in the sauce in the search field, like, you get a lot of stuff. There's a lot of podcasts that are literally about sauce.
Yeah.
They're cooking podcasts and stuff. So you can help us come up at the top of that search and find more listeners. Just get in there, write a few words. It would be so super helpful. Please do it.
Absolutely.
And we look forward to hearing from you via iTunes or email or whatever your chosen form of communication is. Until next week, adios amoebas.
See ya.